Aleph's are Aleph's. If no man's land is where men live who have no land, if you lower your sun shield and block the hilltop settlement, if Wadi al-Nar is the valley of fire, if we must travel beneath the level of our eventual grave, if we arrive and they ask, how are you? We are to say, thank God.
I've been listening to Phil Metris read from Shrapnel Maps. One of the things that people can't see when they hear you read this is that in between each line there's what looks to be one end of a parenthetical. And I was curious about that mark and what it means to you. I spun out with my own theory, but I was interested in what that is doing in the poem.
Well, I'm sort of interested in what you had in mind.
Well, I thought of it in terms of, like, one of the ways I feel like you can enter this collection is as an exercise in and an interrogation of framing. And I don't know if that open one-sided parenthetical that we get after every line in that epic poem is part of that or not. But I think about, for instance, that many of the sections of the book begin with an image of what appears to be an old tourist advertisement meant for Jews that's either idealized or sometimes orientalized and says simply visit or visit Palestine. And so sometimes we'll have a section that will be about something very different than that image, but we're also aware that section begins with that image, that image meant to entice Jews to visit Palestine becomes a frame, an inescapable frame. Is that at all connected? Do you feel like that characterization of your book is something about framing? Does that resonate with you as something you recognize in the project?
Absolutely, 100%. Mark Nowak, in one of his books, the first line is something like, the form is the frame. I think it might be that. But this sort of poetry and this sort of project is deeply invested in thinking about how we come to tell the stories of this place or of any place, and what, in the process of telling a story, which is putting a frame around something, are we leaving out? What's on the margins of that? What's parenthetical to that? And so parentheses, open and closed, are part of our grammar of inclusion and exclusion, partial inclusion, right? Have you ever had been with someone who's read something? This, my students occasionally do this. They'll read, but they'll skip over the parenthetical statements in a sentence. And I said, why are you skipping it over? That doesn't mean it's not important. It just means it's not as important. And so, right, the parentheses is a sort of punctuation of prioritization and the sense of the openness of those, you know, parentheses marks in this poem. It's an attempt to sort of, like, I think, to pry open the sense about what's deprioritized and what's included and what's excluded. It's such a lovely mark too. I don't really understand it. It's almost like to me it also has an optical kind of aspect to it. It's like the lens of an eye, you know? So it has different meanings for me, and I don't want to, you know, just like impose them, but what you said sounds precisely part of the picture. Yeah.
For a lot of the time I was reading Shrapnel Maps, as we've discussed outside of this interview, I was working off of the galley, which you warned me was going to be different than the final version, which I did get in the last couple of weeks. But in the galley, this wedding begins first with the Jewish visit postcard. So the wedding in Palestine is, we have to enter the doorway through the Jewish visit advertisement. But in the final version, it's a piece of art by a Palestinian artist called Remains. And it shows, it also feels like a form of framing the Palestinian woman's face and head. We see half of her face, but then in the other half of her face, instead of her face, we see what looks to be a street scene of Arab men and women, and it's almost as if we're seeing into her mind or into her past, and this is either what she's thinking or what she's remembering, or this is where she's come from. And I couldn't find anything by the artist Manal Deeb where she talks about this specifically, but she does say somewhere, "My grandmother's house is all gone, but in my mind it's still there," which somehow feels related to me to this different form of framing, which feels like it's a framing of memory instead of a framing of imagination. Like the Jewish, I mean, there is a memory aspect perhaps to the Jewish postcard, but it does feel more like an imagined future rather than a more immediately remembered past of this Palestinian artist. But I guess one of the things I wanted to ask you around this and the framing is another thing that changes in the from the galley to the final version is that these postcards, they change over time. The erasures that are being performed on them, the interrogation feel almost like another way you're interrogating framing. But also along with this, we get periodically these erasures of Mark Twain's book, Innocence Abroad. So I was hoping you could tell us about these erasures, and more specifically, you could talk a little bit about why Innocence Abroad and why that book in specific would be a relevant book to put in a book about Israel and Palestine.
Well, I just really appreciate the care with which you brought to looking at the book, reading the book, looking at the images, because you know, as a writer, that's all that we would hope for. And the fact of the matter is, you know, as you have already here observed, there's a lot of doctoring that's happening in some of these images. Some of the very last things I was doing with the book were in fact learning how to, you know, use Photoshop to do this. And I think I didn't have an image for every, like a frontispiece image for every section. There are 10 sections in the book. And I just at some point decided that the images kind of had tailed off in the nearly final version of the book, and that was silly. It was a lost, missed opportunity. And so I went back and looked at the images again. These postcards that you note, tourist postcards that were actually done by I think a really talented you know, a guy from the Mad Men era, you know, in New York, doing these wonderful images, these enticing images. I mean, how could you not want to enter into them, you know? His name is Mitchell Loeb. This was done in 1947, a year before, of course, everything changed. And I had a lot of fun just figuring out how to, like, remove things from images. And all of which is to say, you know, to those who are listening, please just take a good close look at what's there and what's not there. It was a lot of fun to do. And I was thinking about how I was engaging in a process of erasure, even as those images are projections which erase a certain kind of texture and complexity of reality at the same time. So there are layers of, there's palimpsests here of projections and erasures. I won't say much more than that, except that I think that the book, one of the things that I hope the book is doing is demonstrating a kind of subjectivity which is complicit and aware of his own complicity in all manner of projections and erasures. And I think that was really important for me to do. And I believe, although I'm sure that there are other ways to do it, I believe that what I wanted to try to do was to model a certain kind of engagement of radical listening, but also radical self-evaluation and self-reflection as the kind of mediating force of the book, as the subjectivity through which all this is getting filtered. Does that mean the book is totally neutral? Does that mean the book is trying to please both sides? Probably not. And my wife very wisely, you know, tries to get me not to do that. It was a role that I played very well in my family, the peacemaker. But I think that what it is trying to do is, it is trying to engage in a radical project of listening and attention to the ways in which we hear and don't and can't hear the realities of other people. So as a segue to that, you asked about why I would have been choosing Mark Twain's Innocents Abroad as a text to engage in redaction or blackouts with. It's a rather notorious book for those who are who've read any Edward Said, Twain's depictions of the Middle East, and of course, you know, all manner of other places in his travelogue, Innocents Abroad, are well known. I mean, he is not his best self in this book by any stretch of the imagination. To which one of my dear friends and former students, Chris Kemp, said, you know, hey, we get it. He was a product of his time. I don't understand why you're spending so much time with this. It's you're perseverating over it. You know, who cares, really? And I think that, you know, one of the things that I think that good erasures do and good poems that are engaging with other texts do is that they don't simply ironize or expose, you know, in some sort of Marxian false consciousness way, the ways in which people from the past didn't get it. I wanted to show actually that Twain himself was very aware of the problem of representation, even while we can now say, of course, that his representation was charged in many ways, deeply Orientalist. The very first erasure is sort of, or redaction is precisely about that. You know, there's this moment in which he says, and I've redacted here, but these are his words. Basically, I can see easily I must unlearn a great many things concerning Palestine. I must begin a system of reduction. And this sense, this difficulty it is to reduce or to, and that's the process of framing that kind of suddenly removes things from consideration that I wanted to interrogate, and not only interrogate, but that I wanted to consider, to put under consideration for myself and for others, knowing how easy it is when one is in pain and one has comes from a culture that has experienced great suffering to do that, how easy it is to see our own suffering and how hard it is to see the suffering of others.
Well, in that light, I want to ask you more about your portrayal of Jews in Shrapnel Maps and the presence of Jews in your life and art more broadly, because Jews are conspicuously present in your life long before Shrapnel Maps, not just you living in an Orthodox Jewish neighborhood. You're the translator of two Russian Jewish poets, Lev Rubinstein and Sergei Gondalevsky. You have an essay in your book, The Sound of Listening, about the docu-poetics and documentary poetry where you call Charles Reznikov and Muriel Rukeyser the founding father and mother of documentary poetry, and you nominate Allen Ginsberg as the court jester. So you've created sort of a holy trinity of Jewish documentary poets. And when we arrive at Shrapnel Maps, you could have certainly created a great poetry collection on Israel-Palestine, where Israeli Jews are portrayed throughout mainly as antagonists. But in this collection, Jews are portrayed in many different and contradictory ways. We get a broad, I don't think we get a neutral, I don't think you're going for neutrality either, like I don't think even close, but we do get a broad breadth of Jewish actions and beliefs presented. And all this made me think that there must be an ethos or a poetics behind all of this, which I think you've already nodded towards some in what we've discussed already. But in constructing, again, my own imagined narrative of why your life as an Arab American Christian is so engaged with Jews, Jewish poets, and Judaism, I thought of a couple things. One was Padraig O'Tuma, the Irish poet and theologian who blurbed your book, has a saying, "Belonging creates and undoes us." And then I also thought of the Russian haiku you wrote in your collection, Pictures at an Exhibition, that goes, "The Roma mother who mistook you for a son, you mistook for a Roma." And then mainly I thought of Fadi Judah's comments on a concordance of leaves, where he says, "Without other, there is no self, and that other is the stranger who must be loved." And I believe he's talking about the wedding being portrayed in the poem more than he's specifically talking about or necessarily talking about Jews. But nevertheless, I'd love to hear more about your engagement with the other, or with the Jewish other in this case, as a way of moving through the world and making art.
Well, that's a lot, David. That is a lot. Oh my gosh, where to begin? There's this sense, growing up Catholic, that Jewishness was special, was distinct in some way. You don't need to go far to note the great contributions of Jews to culture, medicine, politics, philosophy, religion. So I have great admiration for Jewish cultural life, Jewish poets, those two Russian poets that you mentioned, Lev Rubinstein and Sergei Ganlevsky. They're just absolutely delightful humans as well as genius poets. And of course, growing up Catholic, half the scripture we're reading is inherited. So we are connected, we're kin. And so that's always part of the picture from a sort of religious identity perspective. And I also became really aware of, the embedded kind of, for lack of any other term, anti-Semitism or anti-Jewish framing that's happening in, for example, the New Testament. So during the crucifixion of Jesus, the people are referred to as the Jews. And of course, okay, the Jews were the people, but why call them Jews? And this is because, of course, the scriptures were written 100 years later, and there was this great attempt, and by great I mean severe attempt, to distinguish early Christianity from Judaism. And that kind of this fierceness of this cut or split is embedded in that scripture in ways that can easily be read as or mobilized in anti-Semitic ways. And this was before my time, but I'm aware that when my parents were growing up, that one of the epithets that Catholics would throw at Jewish kids on the street was that they were Christ killers. And that's because partly that's embedded in the scripture. And so being just really attentive and aware of this problem in my own faith tradition and that kind of legacy of the church and its forced inquisitions and its persecution of Jews, there's such a history there. There's a great book called Constantine's Sword, among many others, that's dealing with the responsibility of the church in its practices and ideologies of hatred of Jews or anti-Semitism. So I almost feel like, reading, one of my dad's mentors was Viktor Frankl, like knowing the importance of, these Jewish thinkers and figures, and knowing at the same time the ways in which the church to which I belonged and still belong has been part of the problem of history, makes me kind of just really attuned to that. I don't know if that's answering your question exactly.
No, I think it is.
But
yeah. Well, I wanted to bring up something that you wrote about in The Sound of Listening that I wondered if it was related to the way you portray Jews and shrapnel maps, but maybe it isn't. But either way, I want to bring it into the conversation. I'm going to read two short quotes that you wrote. "In light of the flurry of poetry activity constellating around the term resistance, we need more than ever to consider the possibilities and limits of resistance. After 25 years of thinking and practicing a poetics of resistance, I have found myself oddly resistant to the sudden talk of resistance, as if resistance were merely a matter of hashtags or opposing Trump. After all, there was plenty to resist during the Obama administration. Drone strikes abroad, police killings of black people on the streets, Bashar al-Assad's massacre of civilians in Syria, bankers and predatory capitalists running amok around the globe, ongoing accrual of executive power, the buildup of a shadow security state. But these phenomena did not garner much widespread resistance. And then later you say something that I really love, and you say in this same piece, while I have always courted the idea of poetry as a rhetoric of resistance, I continue to return to the idea of poetry as fundamentally a kind of resistance itself, anti-rhetorical, a state anterior to positing, poetry as the ground of opening into the possible, a refuge. Part of this shift is Zizek's notion that resistance often can sustain the object of its critique. In other words, if our resistance is mere protest, it actually strengthens or even creates the system. I'm not entirely sure where I'm going, but the way in which I feel like this collection is not neutral is I feel like this collection is a critique of Israeli occupation. I feel like this collection is that, but at the same time, the resistance to the occupation that I feel like the book is enacting is also one that's trying to listen to the occupiers. I don't know if I'm reducing what you're doing too much by saying that, but I would like to hear about your poetics of resistance in relationship, or the limits of a poetics of resistance, and trying to create a poetics that's beyond a poetics of resistance.
Yeah, well, I don't know. You probably, being an interested person in culture, watched The Wire at some point, or you know about The Wire. Recently, The Wire was criticized by someone about its depiction of policing, and one of the things I loved about Wendell Pierce, who plays Bunk, tweeted a really eloquent statement about how he saw actually police depicted as people, flawed human beings caught in systems larger than themselves, in which they find their humanity compromised, and in which, this is a paraphrase, but this is the way I understand it, in which they also perpetrate inhumanity. It's a Dickensian work in some ways, or maybe a Tolstoyan work. And it's actually, Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and, modern iterations that are able to kind of show us people situated in systems that are not always protecting them and not always protecting others. That's what interests me as an artist. I'm interested, for example, what happened in Sand Opera was something really similar. I started with, because my emotional taproot was reading the testimonies of the abused Iraqi prisoners. But that story was not complete if I didn't wrestle with and engage with, and then also in some respects depict and account for, the American military police who were either bystanders or perpetrators or whistleblowers. And so I think that something really similar kind of is happening in this book, Shrapnel Maps, which is to say, it would be really easy for me simply to please Palestinian human rights people and do a book that is doing that work. But that's not going to help people wrestle with, and here's a word that gets us all into trouble, the complexities or complications of that predicament. And I think good art, I think art of the moral imagination is able to do that. Now, is that different than an art of resistance? I think it is, actually. It's a little bit different. Does it mean that there are ways in which this could be mobilized in a kind of resistance? Sure. But things would be cut out. And there are poems that I don't think are great poems in this collection that are necessary because they offer another facet to this, you know, this picture. And there's more than one dimension of the picture. So I think that that was really important to me. And that doesn't mean, and that's partly because it accounts for my situatedness. I am not a Palestinian. I am not a Jew. I am in some ways, I'm proximate to, but I am not part of, you know, other than say my taxes or something like that, or the, you know, my brother-in-law. I'm not really part of this. And I think one of the things that struck me most about the book, and I think as, you know, any artist, you want to be surprised by what you write. I think one of the things that surprised me was that I feel like my life is more aligned with the predicament of an Israeli person than it is a Palestinian person. And I think that probably a lot of activists have the same issue, but they don't want to see that. And that is to say, you know, people were pushed out of here, you know, like
meaning America.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so just kind of recognizing that and coming to terms with that was really important to me. I'm really, so there's kind of two sides of my personality, and that's expressed in the quote that you read, a deep passion for not only resistance, but for moving in solidarity and allyship with people who are marginalized, who don't necessarily have the power that I may have given my position or standing in life. And also this attempt and desire to understand and imagine different positionalities that include me, that demonstrate my own complicity. And I hope that answers your question. I'm not sure it does.
I think it does. Are you up for reading Is Dude as a final poem?
I do want to read this poem. So Is Dude is for Fadi Judah. Fadi's family came from Is Dude, which is a village which is mostly destroyed now, although there's some remnants. And the Israeli city of Ashdod is proximate to it at present. Fadi is a wonderful poet and translator of Darwish and Zakhtan and many others. And he's also just a really profound and delicate thinker. He's also a bit of a provocateur, but that's not in the poem. I mean, for me, like, he's always like, you know, telling me how I'm wrong. Bless him. Is Dude for Fadi Judah. Dear descendant of the disappeared, you ascend the pillar of your own air, spin and span whole abysses with lions translating there to here and here to where wind whines in dry wadis, hoists sea in handful after invisible handful. Is due to now your email address and digital image of branches through windows within school ruins. A refugee points with his cane to what he only can see. You argue against the argument against yourself you yourself make and home in. Kiss my blind eyes clear, close keyholes with opening, homeland you, cradle and vowels, what was not, never yours. I'll hold it here till you return.
Thank you so much for being on the show today, Phil.
Thank you so much, Dave. It's been great. You're an incredible reader and a gracious host.
We've been talking today to the poet, essayist, and translator Philip Metris about his latest book from Copper Canyon Press, Shrapnel Maps. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio and the Jazz Society of Oregon are thrilled to bring you the 40th Annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, July 17th, 18th, and 19th, as a live streaming event. Tune in and you'll hear the area's finest jazz, blues, R&B, and Latin musicians over the course of 3 days. The Bayou Boys, Bobby Torres, Saida Wright, and Tezetta Band are just a few of the 15 bands performing this year. That's the 40th Annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, streaming live and on KBOO, Portland's longest-running community event, July 17th, 18th, and 19th. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage. I've been in the right place, but it must have been the wrong time. I'd have said the right thing.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Esta es una sección especial en español en respuesta